All right, let's get Andrew to bed.
Oh, hello, everybody.
Hello, and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur. And Andrew, look at me.
I'm looking.
Look at me.
I'm looking.
I'm the captain now.
Ooh. Did that come out this year?
The events happened this year.
That's based on a real story. No, I'm just kidding. I've actually never seen the film Captain Phillips, but I've seen that scene.
Well, what's your name?
My shadow name is Slaughterhouse, but my name is Andrew, and I'm a professional film historian. And AWOL has heard me because Avatar.
Did Avatar The Last Airbender come out this year?
No.
This is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen.
But I most likely have.
From every year. This week, we are in 2009. We're watching Dogtooth, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. For any new listeners, you can find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. I rented this one on Amazon. What about you, Andrew?
Oh, I also rented it on Amazon.
What is going on in 2009? We always like to give a little bit of context for the year. That's going to be important this year. 2009, we're in the middle of the Great Recession, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And according to analysts, the worst is over as of 2009, late 2009. But the impact will continue to be felt for quite a while, for sure. I mean, you don't just come out of these things, do you?
Right.
The World Health Organization declares swine flu a global pandemic this year. I remember that for sure.
Oh, yeah. H1N1, right?
That's right. They took us out of school, and I remember going to see Wolverine, the X-Men origin story.
Wait, you got out of school for that?
Uh-huh.
Not in Alabama.
Oh, this is relevant. In January, Russia shuts off gas supplies to Europe over a debt dispute with Ukraine. Sounds very familiar.
Hmm.
And in the Indian Ocean, Somali pirates hijack a cargo ship, later to be turned into the film Captain Phillips. Michael Jackson dies this year. In mysterious circumstances.
I know. I saw This Is It came out this year, and I was like, oh, wow. That was a replacement for his tour that obviously wouldn't happen, and the whole thing was released as sort of a in memoriam thing. Did you mention the Mayan calendar situation in 2009?
I mean, I was going to mention it in 2012 for sure, but it's definitely worth bringing up in 2009 because we got a movie coming out.
We had a movie come out, and it wasn't just that. It was like 2008 and 2009 was when that was a real cultural thing. Everyone was talking about it.
Yeah.
Everyone said December 21st, 2012, it's all going down. Spoiler alert for the 2012 episodes, I feel like by the time 2012 came along, it was more of a joke than anything. I feel like these were the years when it was a real, it felt like a real threat for some reason.
I thought it was a joke the entire time. Were people taking this seriously? It wasn't like Y2K, was it?
People were taking this so seriously, man. I knew people who had bunkers. Huh. I had family members who had land bought that they said, this is the location to go if anything goes down.
Based on the Mayan calendar.
Sure. Yeah, I really do think everyone just wanted the world to end.
And we still do. Deep down.
We do. It was a disappointment.
And it will continue to be a disappointment. Have you seen Roland Emmerich's 2012?
Oh, yes, honey. That movie is awesome.
That Roland Emmerich. He's a funny guy.
He is a funny guy. I appreciate Roland Emmerich. And I'm sorry, like, he's the only gay director that comes to mind who gets to deal with these big budget movies. So he gets my respect. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. 2012 is number 5 at the worldwide box office this year. So what could possibly be number 1 in 2009, Andrew?
It's got to be the Coen brothers' A Serious Man. Shattered box office. Records.
Classic.
That's a great movie. Spoiler alert, that's one of my recommendations for the year. But of course it's Avatar. I love this movie, though. I love Avatar. I love this movie so much. I saw this thing 9 times in theaters.
It is hard to overstate how big of a film this was, though. Like, everyone was going to see this thing, and they were going to see it multiple times. I myself saw it 3 times, but I know other people who were going to see it 2 times. Just regular folks who were like, wow, that was incredible. I got to go see it again. And the backlash since then has been really vicious. But I remember at the time, everyone was kind of in agreement that this is the greatest thing in cinematic history. Everyone was in love with Avatar for like a month.
I think the reason why I'm able to be so comfortable with my love of Avatar now is because I went through my denial phase while it was still in theaters. The first time I saw it, I was blown away by the visuals, but I just, like so many people, was like, wow, this story, how many times we're going to have to hear this story? And then the second time I saw it, I was like, I think the visuals just do enough to make me not need the story to be anything spectacular, you know? And then the third time I saw it, I remember I saw it with my friends Catherine and Elliot, and they hated it. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, this is just like crap. Like, this is just soulless garbage. Doesn't mean anything. And then I saw it a fourth time with Noah in 3D IMAX. And I think it was his like fifth time. And at the end of it, we were both just crying. And I was like, wait, no, this is just a great movie. So I went through all of this, but I feel like a lot of people saw it once or twice and are now in their doubt phase, and they haven't had that next viewing where they're just crying.
Yeah, I remember people like dressing up. I remember people going into their fantasy worlds. This was a big deal.
People love to say Avatar was like this huge thing for 3D, and I do agree with them, but I had a 3D movie experience earlier this same year that was just as mind-blowing to me, and that was Henry Selick's masterpiece, Coraline, which I think is a wonderful movie. Because Henry Selick had said that they had filmed it using 3D cameras with the stop-motion puppets, and that it was meant to be seen in 3D, and it was so incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, I still love that movie. I've seen it many times since I saw it in theaters for the first time.
Stop Motion had a real swing this year. Fantastic Mr. Fox came out this year, too, and that's a great movie.
Ooh, yes, it is. Yes, it is.
They both flopped. So sad.
And even today, Stop Motion flops at the box office. It's sad. I love Stop Motion, obviously, because I have Stop Motion in my little monster short film. Mm-hmm. It is a lovely, lovely art form. Very fun. Very fun to implement. Always looks charming on screen, I think. But yeah, I don't know if audiences see that and they just say, oh, that's old. I don't want to go. I don't know. But
I don't know either, but I do think that talking about stop motion in 2009 is a great way to get into my first official recommendation of the year, which is Adam Elliott's Mary and Max, which is a movie to watch when you don't want to live anymore.
Oh.
Just kidding.
Okay.
Well, no, it is. The ending is so hopeful.
Okay, good, 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 good.
Have you never seen Mary and Max?
No.
Girl, write that title down. It's about these two characters who are pen pals to each other, and they are sort of each other's only friends. So the majority of the film is a conversation between two stop-motion puppets who don't actually get to see each other, and they are voiced by Toni Collette and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And again, as we've talked about, you know, from Persepolis and Waltz with Bashir, this is the adult-oriented sort of major-budget animated film that came out this year.
This looks great.
A super underrated sci-fi horror flick from this year is Pandorum, directed by Christian Alvart.
Oh, I've seen it.
It is literally a mashup of The Descent and Event Horizon, but it really works. This movie is so messed up. It's so scary. It's so tense. The third act is so satisfying. There's just so much to like about this movie, and it tells a really poignant story about humanity, too, in the middle of all of its schlocky B-horror bits. This is a very good movie, and I remember seeing the poster in theaters and being freaked out by it, and I still think it's a wacky poster. Next up is Jason Reitman's Up in the Air.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a film that analyzes the sort of burst bubble of job opportunity in America. You're following a man played by George Clooney whose job is to go into big corporate offices and fire people. That's what he's hired to do, is so the boss doesn't have to look bad and the HR person doesn't have to look bad. They hire George Clooney. He comes in and fires people. And similarly to District 9, but I think much more tastefully done, there are real interviews with people who had just lost their jobs that are cut into the movie. And it was just Jason Reitman and those people, because the way the scenes are shot, it's a shot reverse shot. So you just see the people being interviewed, then it cuts to George Clooney's reaction. So they're never in the same room. So Jason Reitman was having these very deep conversations with people who'd lost their jobs around 2008. And this is just a phenomenal movie. The script is so good. Anna Kendrick really gets to prove herself as an actor. And both George Clooney and Vera Farmiga are exquisite. It's just a great movie. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, definitely a movie for the times. I think I got this film as a gift for my high school girlfriend, like on DVD.
Oh, you received it as a gift?
No, I gave it to her as a gift.
Oh, I would take that as a weird signal. Someone I was in a relationship with. I would.
Yeah.
The romantic melodrama of that film is not kind towards long-term relationships.
Well, we're no longer in a long-term relationship, so it all makes sense, really.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, man. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. It wasn't anything you did. It was her. You're better off. I don't even know who this woman is. And it is my absolute delight, and it might not be the last time this happens, to give a double bill Korean thriller horror double feature recommendation to Park Chan-wook's Thirst, which is a comedy drama horror about vampires in South Korea that is so ridiculous, so campy, so funny. And then in the third act, he gets ya. He gets ya. It becomes so emotional right at the end, and he just nails it. God, nobody messes with the genre like Park Chan-wook. Except for, perhaps, Bong Joon-ho, whose film Mother also came out this year. Mm. And this is a crazy thriller about a woman whose son is accused of murder, and she goes to ridiculous lengths to prove his innocence. And that is all you get to know about either of those movies. I am not one to be all about spoilers, but those narratives are so inventive and creative. I still watch them today and get little goose pimples. Great movies that came out in 2009, both of them. If you're going to watch them together, which I truly would recommend, the correct order is Thirst, then Mother.
Awesome. I haven't seen Thirst. I love Mother.
Oh, yeah, you'd love Thirst. You just love it.
Mm.
And then, of course, I mentioned it a little earlier, the Coen brothers' A Serious Man comes out this year. And to me personally, this is in the running for their best movie. I love this movie. It's so darkly humorous. It's their adaptation of the Book of Job told through their perspective of Jewish guilt. It's really funny. It's really heartwarming. It's really sad. And the final shot of this movie haunts me. Haunts me. Have you seen this one?
I've seen it many times, actually. I really love A Serious Man.
Yeah. And a film that I notoriously did not understand on first viewing. If you really hate a movie the first time you watch it, it might be worth revisiting. That's all I will say.
Terminator Salvation. Oh, no, sorry. I thought we were getting into your next
recommendation. No, you should have said X-Men Origins Wolverine, which we both saw in theaters.
Yep.
You saw it while you were in quarantine. I just saw it because I had no friends. I'm just kidding. I actually had a lot of friends at this point in my life. Me and Nathan saw this together in theaters. And at the end, we were like, that was crap. Like, I was not having it. I don't remember if he was as violent towards it as I was, but I hated it.
I think everyone hated X-Men Origin Wolverine, including the people who made it, because they went and made another X-Men prequel. with Wolverine. So
there is something interesting to be discussed with Wolverine. Do you remember the torrent of the film leaking 3 months before it came out, and the torrent had unfinished visual effects?
Yeah, I remember that.
It was just a crazy situation. The only way that cut could have been released is someone deep on the inside releasing it.
I'm surprised that doesn't happen more often now, honestly.
Well, streaming killed torrenting. It killed it. What's interesting is that the studio came out and made this big statement, like, it was because of the torrent that it underperformed at the box office. The thing that they didn't understand was that if the torrent had released, even with unfinished visual effects, and it had been an incredible movie, if people had just been so enraptured by it, people would have gone to see it to see the finished effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we aren't here to discuss X-Men Origins Wolverine, although we could have made a really good episode out of it, because I am sure neither of us remember enough details about that movie to not constitute a revisit. But this year, we are discussing Yorgos Lanthimos's Dogtooth.
It's a Greek film. You got the plot.
I have a very easy plot. This is a film about a family that are living in this huge house. They are clearly of some sort of upper class. The father of the family abuses the children, is teaching them weird word substitutions, and is just sheltering them from the outside world, refuses to let them go out into the outside world. To help his son with his sexual urges, he hires a security guard named Christina to come in and have sexual relations with him. However, this ends up working against everybody's wishes because Christina is dissatisfied with the sex and so moves on to the sister. The sister becomes obsessed with the secular world through Christina. The father abuses the girl, beats Christina up with a VCR player, and then the sister performs a dance from Flashdance in front of her parents and knocks out her dog tooth, which she believes is something that she has to do to reach maturity because of the aforementioned lies her father has told her. And she runs out of the house, hides herself inside of the back of the car. The father searches frantically for her but can't find her. He drives the car to work the next day, and she is trapped in the trunk. You think she's dead?
No, I don't.
I do.
I don't think she's dead, and I think it's actually important thematically to think that she's not dead. But I'm curious to hear why you think she might be dead.
I think it's something about the car still running and the exhaust going, because you're really not supposed to inhale that much exhaust.
You really shouldn't be doing that. She's probably dead, but I think she's still alive, but literally she does not have the conception of how to escape, what to do if she were to leave, because that's just not the world she has ever experienced. She doesn't have the capacity to imagine a world in which she opens the trunk and steps outside without the guidance of her father. She won't do it. So I think she's just trapped in there forever.
Huh.
She will die.
Just as bleak.
Just as bleak. Yes.
What'd you think?
I love this film. I love this film a lot. And I watched it twice, which I have not done for many of the films on our list.
Wow.
It's a weird film. It's really strange. It's really icky. I didn't know how to take it at first. Was it a comedy? Was it a horror? Was it a drama? And it's kind of all of those things, which I should have been prepared for. Yorgos Lanthimos has done other films that have made me feel similarly uncomfortable, such as The Lobster and, to a lesser extent, The Favorite. I think The Favorite is a little bit more just straight comedy, but it's still really freaking weird.
I think the most comparable film he's made since is Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Which I have not seen.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Well, yeah, May I tell you the story of how I watched this film for the first time?
Yeah, of course.
So, I used to be the person who would babysit people who did drugs when I was in college. And it was not even my intention to do so. They would seek me out and enjoyed being around me, and I just didn't do anything like that at that time, but they were my friends, and I loved hanging out with them. And so one of the very first meetups, it was like, we are going to do acid, and then we are going to meet up with Andrew. They wanted to do a movie night, which now, with more experience in my life, I'm like, why? Why would you ever want to do that with any movie? And they wanted to do a double feature. And the double feature was Dogtooth and Mulholland Drive.
No! Why?
In retrospect, I gotta say, they were champs. From my perspective, if I'd have been in that situation, I would have just gotten up and been like, I'm gonna go take a walk. Like, I would have been like, I'm gonna go outside and breathe in fresh air and have a good time and not torture myself. The thing about it is that one of the funniest jokes in this movie is a brutal killing of a tiny cat. And it's the way it's framed and presented, and then when they cut to the dead cat, it is this very silly looking puppet cat that's like, rah! Like, it has this like face of abject terror with shears inside of it. And I'm sitting there with these two people who are flipping out, not having a good time, and I couldn't hold it anymore. I just started laughing so hard. And I was like, this is so funny. And me laughing at it made it weird.
You made it weird.
They did not take that well. So, I I'm good at reading a room. I'm good at knowing what the situation is. I was enjoying the film so much that I didn't want to turn it off. So I was like, okay, I'm feeling like this is a comedy, but I'm going to watch this again later on my own. I already know this. So we're just going to get through. And then the father picks up the VHS player and just starts beating Christina with it. And again, it's like, like, I'm trying to keep it in. But this is just so, it's dark, it's messed up, it's horrifying, but it is so funny. Like, him taking that as the symbol of the secular world. The symbol of the secular world in 2009 being represented by a VHS player was just primo already. And then him, like, cursing her future generations and stuff for her addiction to the secular world. I was just like, I can't hold this. I'm going to just start laughing. And again, did not play well to that crowd. We are still friends today, but I think there was always a sort of a separation between us after that because they did not understand how I could think it was funny. That was in 2011, so now 11 years later, all I think is, no, I was right. This is a really funny movie, and it's messed up and uncomfortable and disorienting and sort of makes you feel a little gross, but it is funny.
There might be a separation between you and I, Andrew.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think this is a funny film. I was trying to find the humor in it, but I really thought this was messed up. I mean, I like that it's messed up. It's really freaking dark. But I didn't find almost any of it funny. There are certain little moments here that I thought were ironic. But yeah, I was never laughing with this or laughing at it. That being said, I don't blame you.
I think the movie does a really good job of making you so uncomfortable, you kind of feel like you need to laugh, and then leans into it further and thinks, if I've made you laugh at that, I can take it a step further. Outside of that cat puppet is stupid looking, and it is intentional. He did not have to cut to that shot. He did not have to keep that in for us to know what happened.
I don't know, man. I totally disagree. I think that cat puppet, which you think looks stupid with the tongue hanging out, like, I mean, it looks pathetic, but when animals die and their tongues are hanging out, I don't know. It's It's not funny to me. It's just disgusting. Same thing with the VCR that he's smashing her head with. Like, I thought that was really disturbing. Y'all hear this, right? Y'all hear what he's doing?
The only thing that will make this worse is if any of you actually go and watch this movie and you will be like, what the fuck is wrong with Andrew? But I'm not alone. I'm not the only person who laughs out loud during this movie. David Lynch,
you are not,
has my back.
What did I think was really funny? I thought it was really funny when the sister blames the cat for coming through the window and hitting her brother with a hammer. That was funny.
Yes.
I thought that the brother being scared of the cat in general was kind of funny.
So
and backing
funny.
Away from it. I mean, just he's never seen this animal before. Who knows what it is? So, yeah, that was kind of funny. But yeah, I felt really sad for these people.
It is sad. It's sad. No, it's sad. And I would never deny that.
I thought it was funny when the father is playing Frank Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon and translating the English lyrics into Greek and telling them just something wildly different, something totally different, just telling them that, one, that this is their grandfather, great-grandfather who's singing, but then also saying that the lyrics are just Frank Sinatra saying like how great family is and how they need to obey the father and all this crap. So that was kind of silly. There's a lot of silliness in this film. I mean, the dancing, of course, and whatnot. I do not blame you for thinking this is funny because there is a lot of clear comedy going on. But I am surprised that, I mean, the VCR thing, that was disturbing.
I guess this is my question, and I'm really not looking for a sob story here from myself, but how comparable would you say your upbringing is to this family?
Not comparable.
See,
Mom, Dad, you are lovely people.
See, I think that is the point of because I grew up so sheltered. I grew up being taught things that were not true about the outside world. I grew up being told in a way like how to perceive certain people, how to perceive certain things in the world. I would mention observations I'd made about people that were neutral to me, and my parents would sway my opinion in a way that was meant to make me sort of be disgusted and hate the secular world and the outside world. And in 2011, when I first watched this, I mean, at that point, I had finally fully blossomed. I really blossomed in theater school. Actually, I would say 2009, the year the movie came out, was a year of that I really fully blossomed into myself. That was when I first was like, this is who I am. So by 2011, I was comfortable in my skin. And I think watching something that was such a send up of a family that is, well, specifically of a father figure who is trying to shield and protect his family from the secular world, I think it was just the medicine I needed. And I still think it is. I love this movie. And again, if you watch this and you don't laugh and you don't find any of it funny and you're just very disturbed by it, like, I'm not holding that against anyone either.
In general, the reactions from critics and audiences in 2009 were incredibly positive, though. I don't know if they were finding it funny or disturbing or what. Everyone seems to be talking about how it's both in the reviews that I'm reading. But the one review that kind of got my attention was from the Prime Minister of Greece. You had to translate this link I sent you.
I did. And I don't think it's a great translation, but luckily it's only like two sentences.
Quote, the news that the film Feng by Georgios Lanthimos is nominated for an Oscar.
I also wonder if the Greek word for dogtooth would just translate to fang.
Oh, maybe.
It is her fang that she knocks out. So maybe that's what they're referring to.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
So never mind, this is a perfect translation.
But this little quote here is from Prime Minister George Papandreou. Probably pronouncing that totally wrong. January 25th, I think in 2011. So a couple years after the film has come out. But incredibly strong words of encouragement, support, admiration for the film and the director. In general, I feel like Dogtooth and Lanthimos are just looked upon with a lot of pride by the Greek population. Maybe not everyone. But I do have a friend who's Greek, and she knew who Lanthimos was and had told me to watch Dogtooth. Said, you got to watch this film. And I said, guess what? We're watching it for our podcast.
Aww.
So yes, it seems like this was a film that had a lot of support and pride behind it at the time. I mean, the prime minister came out and was saying how much he appreciated it and what it was doing at the Oscars and attention it was getting. That's cool.
And keep in mind, this piece was published in 2011. We've never really discussed this aspect of the A Century in Cinema list. We've discussed that it's based off of Letterboxd released years, but there is a lot of controversy around what Letterboxd considers to be the year a film releases, and a lot of people would consider this to be a 2010 or a 2011 film. And at this point, Grease was sort of a punching bag as far as the world at large because of their crazy financial crisis. And I'm not saying it was funny or that it was anything to mock. I'm just saying America specifically was poking fun at them. It was like, because ours had been really bad too, but not that bad. And so it was like this weird sense of superiority. Do you remember anything about that? Do you remember those emotions around the Greek financial collapse?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember seeing it on the news. I don't remember many people in my circles poking fun at Greece. It was more of a sense of fear. Like, Greece and their financial collapse, what was going on with their debt crisis had to do with the Great Recession going on. It was a fallout from,
right,
you know, everything going on at the time with the global financial collapse. So it was kind of seen as like a worst case scenario for a developed country. Like, oh my God, this is how bad it could get. I mean, I don't know the specifics of bonds and how you really calculate these sort of things, debt ratios and that kind of thing. But I do know that there was a huge brain drain. A lot of the wealthier and more educated people in Greece were leaving, and that's really bad for a country. So it was kind of like this scary thing that, oh my God, a country like this can go through a collapse. But I don't remember it being funny or anyone poking fun at it, at least in my circles.
I guess at this point, I was still very much paying attention to more conservative news sources, and I feel like that's where that sense of sort of leering over it and pointing at them and laughing sort of came from.
Hmm. A lot of the snippets from Greek critics that I saw on Wikipedia were saying, you know, how great this film was in terms of just getting respect from Hollywood. It meant a lot that this piece of art was getting respect from the outside world and from America.
Yes.
So, yeah, I can see that. I can see that. Yeah.
I've mentioned before, these are the years of hearsay around movies. And sort of one of the main talking points around this film when it was first out, definitely one of the reasons I sought it out, was it was a Greek perspective on the Greek financial collapse. But learning that he made this film well before that and that it was released, I mean, it was impending at that point and things were looking bad, but it wasn't made during the financial collapse, as a lot of people had led me to believe at the time.
Right. And I think I read somewhere that Lanthimos said he didn't intend for this film to be an allegory for any sort of government.
But it was a Greek film that came out then, and so it was impossible not to interpret that into it at some degree.
It is impossible to watch this film and not think of it as some sort of allegory, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
It works so well on just a micro level. Like, it feels like an allegory for the way that you are raised in a family, how families themselves can be very cult-ish and cut off from the outside world in a lot of ways. So that the things you're raised with, that's thinking of as normal, you know, are not normal sometimes. And even in my case, there are certain things that I was raised with that I thought of as normal. And then I get out into the outside world and I'm like, oh, wait, this is not normal. It's not nearly as bad as your situation, and obviously not as bad as the situations in this film.
Right.
But it's still an allegory. It's still a metaphor that works.
And again, the word I used was comparable, but it didn't help that I'm the middle son of an older and a younger sister as well.
But then, of course, the allegory works on a macro level, too. I mean, thinking of the way that governments and people in power try to influence the people they have power over and cut them off from the outside world. I mean, propaganda, this is how it works. And just shaping the way that a country and a population thinks, and usually for the worst, usually for the benefit of the people in power, of course. Yeah, I really liked what this film was saying, even if Lanthimos didn't necessarily intend for it to say those things.
And I do think that intent is important, but interpretation is equally important. I think one of the reasons this film became a minor success in the American indie film market was because so many people thought that's what it was about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's impossible not to watch this film and just, at least for me, think of the way that, you know, the cultural norms we grew up with, not necessarily just the governments and the people in power, like what they do to impose their thoughts on us, like just the way that society in general comes to form the way we think. I mean, what do words even mean? What is a zombie? What is a keyboard?
I mean, even a pussy being the giant light in the room, the mom has to come up with that one really quick.
Yeah.
That scene is really good. And I feel like it is a very subtle way of showing how unstable this situation really is. Because our first introduction to them learning these word replacement things to make them not know what the outside world is, it's on a tape recorder and it's thought through, and there's clearly a rehearsal involved to a certain extent. But in that moment when she has to divine what the lamp is and has to do a word swap, she looks to the husband quickly for reassurance. He sort of gives her the nod, and then she makes it up right there at the table. You know, again, impossible not to think of a government allegory there. Like, oh, they do a really good job of putting on a show that everything is under control. But things are very unstable and rocky, and a lot of this stuff is being made up while we're doing it. That didn't make you laugh at all?
Oh, the pussy?
Yes.
The light of the pussy? That was kind of funny. I didn't laugh, but I thought it was funny.
I got to watch this with Graham sometimes. I know he loves this movie, and he and I are always laughing at this kind of crap. But you also weren't laughing during the celebration.
No. No, I wasn't. But I was more ready to give you that was a straight-up comedy. I don't know why. This feels way more sick.
To me, like, the sicker a movie is, the more I feel like it's trying to be a comedy. I don't know, because at the end of the day, you know it's a movie. And the stunts in this are so impressive. That really was my main takeaway on this viewing. The abuse and everything, it's all fake. None of it's real. And it looks so real. It looks so violent.
When the father duct tapes the VHS to his hand and then just slams it into the daughter's head.
That we only get to assume is a copy of Flashdance. Oh. I want to ask you if you're aware of what happened to Mary Soni. She played the youngest daughter.
No, I must not be.
She was not an actress. She was in a punk rock band that Georgios really liked. He essentially said, you don't have to be a great actor to be able to play this role, which was a way of selling her on it. But she does give a wonderful performance in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
She passed away a month before she turned 30. She had a rupture. It's still kind of mysterious. She had some sort of rupture and her lungs filled with bodily fluid, and she was just found in her apartment.
Oh, that's quite sad.
It is very sad. See, that's not funny. But
is that not funny because it actually happened in real life?
Correct.
Okay.
You know what movie this film always reminds me of that isn't funny to me? Is The Apple. And I think I might have recommended this film.
Sounds familiar, but I definitely haven't seen it.
If I've said all this before, whatever. It's an Iranian film, and it was directed by a 17-year-old woman who saw on the news this story about this father and his blind wife, and he kept his two daughters inside of the house and refused to let them leave, and they created their own language.
Mm.
And this really happened, and the film, The Apple, is a depiction of these events played out by the actual family.
Ooh.
But the thing about that movie is that it's not trying to be satirical or ironic. It's showing sympathy towards everyone involved. It's showing sort of a heart and a reason behind why someone would do something like this. And also, it isn't super messed up or disturbing. The father isn't abusive, and there isn't all this other crazy stuff going on. You know, it was purely out of a sense of protection, but that's a real thing that happened. And in Dogtooth, it's presented in this super heightened way and taken to the absolute worst possible case scenario, which is where the comedy comes from in my mind.
Hmm.
But The Apple presents such an authentic and realistic depiction that it doesn't feel like Dogtooth, where you can't help but think this is far away from humanity. It's depicting something that looks and feels realistic while I'm watching it, but in real life, this situation does not feel tangible. Whereas in The Apple, you are seeing a family where not only could it happen, it did happen. And that's a really great film. I love that movie. And this film gets compared a lot to a movie called The Castle of Purity, but I've never seen that.
Oh, I saw that comparison. Oh, I saw that comparison as well. In general, I really like these stories about, you know, isolation, people being cut off from the outside world and growing up in a different way. I mean, that's such a weird scenario.
Right.
There's a lot of drama to be found there. And yeah, all of the real life scenarios that these kinds of films get compared to, you know, the kids being raised and never seeing the outside world. This happens. This is real sick stuff that you can read about on Wikipedia, go down a whole rabbit hole. And kids who think they're like wolves, you know, they think they're animals because they've never really encountered a real human relationship because their parents like cut them off. It's crazy. I don't know where I'm going with that.
Me neither. When I was revisiting this earlier this week, I was thinking, oh, wow, this is a very similar film to The Celebration, mostly in tone, but also with, you know, themes of sexual abuse within the family.
Mm-hmm.
And this controlling, dominating spirit.
They're similar, but I mean, The Celebration was a great jumping off point to talk about Dogma 95 and that whole movement. And I feel like this is a great film to jump off and talk about, I mean, as we already have done, the financial crisis going on in Greece and the Great Recession going on in the world and government reaction to said crises. And it's also a great jumping off point to talk about Yorgos Lanthimos and his whole career, because he started off as a celebrated director in Greece, and now it feels like everyone kind of knows who he is. I know a lot of people who saw The Favorite.
Oh, yeah. I was at a sold out early screening of that movie. You know what? I'm just going to say it. And if I eat my words, I eat my words. Poor Things, my favorite film of 2023. For sure. Have you read the plot synopsis?
No, I have not.
May I read this to you?
Read it to me and serenade our listeners.
This is Yorgos Lanthimos' next film. It's called Poor Things. It's coming out next year, starring Emma Stone and Willem Dafoe. Upon drowning herself to escape her abusive husband, a woman has her brain replaced with the brain of her unborn child with the help of an eccentric scientist named Godwin Baxter. And baby, that sounds like a 10. That sounds like a 10.
Yeah, that sounds great. Emma Stone and Willem Dafoe in the same movie? I'm already in.
Yes, Willem Dafoe collaborating with Yorgos Lanthimos feels right.
Is it Giorgos Lanthimos or Yorgos Lanthimos?
I've been saying Yorgos Lanthimos literally my entire life until we read that Prime Minister statement. You can hear me say Yorgos Lanthimos at the beginning of this episode, and after we read that Prime Minister statement, I realized, wait, it would be pronounced Giorgos Lanthimos.
Well, my confusion is understandable then.
So I learned something while we recorded today.
We've got it on tape.
I'm happy we recorded that because I was low-key thinking, I wonder if anyone's going to catch that I just correct my pronunciation halfway through the episode. But I thought that might be a little subtle joke.
It's a joke for those who stuck around till the end.
Right. Is this the end?
I am looking through our I'm looking through our show notes, and I don't see anything else necessarily to talk about.
I'll say this for Giorgos Lanthimos as well. This was a time when it first started happening that every small independent film director got to then go on to make a big budget Hollywood action movie. And he made Dogtooth, and then he made Alps, which I have not seen. But then after Alps was when he got his first Hollywood studio deal. And that's when he made The Lobster. And I just have so much respect for the fact that once he got more money, he started making weirder movies. The Favorite was cool because The Favorite, he fully leaned into, okay, I'll do a more quote-unquote conventional comedy. But all of the laughs are still going to be born of gross weirdness, disgusting misinformation, and awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's kind of a key. I feel like when you watch The Favorite and you realize what exactly you're laughing at, I think you'll come around a Dogtooth and say, oh, this is actually really funny. Because this isn't your last time watching this movie, I can tell.
I've already watched it twice.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed my revisit of this film. This was my first time watching it since 2012.
Oh, wow.
It was very nice to come back. Just as good as I remembered it. Just as funny. Performances are crazy. This is just such a well-thought-out vision. So well-directed. And I don't know, it's just a very brave movie. Just a very gutsy movie. You don't see a lot of movies that feel like they are trying to say something while also shock you.
And it is shocking.
It's a shocking film.
Maybe not for everyone.
No. Oh, my God. I don't think my parents would make it 5 minutes into the thing.
I don't know if my parents would love this either.
It would absolutely cement their opinion of me if they did watch it. Listening to this. They'd be like, okay, our son is friends with an absolute lunatic and made a 2-year-long project with him.
Hello, Andrew's parents. We're having a good time over here.
Aw. I don't think they're listening, but that's okay. At this point, I've been functioning as if they aren't for so long that it would really weird me out if they were to be like, we started listening.
So yes, not for everybody. But the film works on a micro level. It works on a macro level. I love what it's saying. I love the icky feeling that I got throughout it. You know, some people don't like watching movies and getting like weird icky feelings, but
I love it.
To be confronted with something really disturbing and to have to wrestle with that and now what do I do as I take away the message of this film? What do I make of this? I kind of love that. And yeah, it made me question, like, what are the cultural norms that I've just come to accept as I've grown up? What should I challenge? What should I really, like, push myself to understand more about? Yeah, I think it's a great film.
Awesome. I'm really happy you liked this one. Well, Arthur, another 10 episodes in the can.
Moving right along. We're going to do a little retrospective on the aughts.
Yes, the early 2000s.
What do you think of the term aughts? I know some people have never even heard of it, and I have to kind of casually explain what it is.
I don't think I have any emotional reaction to it.
Okay. What are some of the big trends you saw? What are some of the big themes in film history? And this is really strange to talk about film history from a time that feels so recent. Definitely some big changes going on. And we lived through them. We saw them. We went to the theaters and everything. Yeah, what's going on?
There's a huge comfort in pushing buttons. I feel like most of the films we watched from this decade involved a certain amount of criticism towards the filmmakers and creators' own governments, own countries, the current world issues, and there was a certain confidence in it. It read more like Veronica Voss than it did, say, The Ascent. Even though I would consider both of those confident and great movies, one was made with the confidence of a filmmaker who knew his country already hated him and he could say whatever he wanted because he was adored by so many. And one was made by a female filmmaker who was confident when making the film, but then upon releasing it was thrown into a situation where she sort of had to pretend that the message she'd intended wasn't entirely there.
So you feel like this decade is marked by films where filmmakers, like the Veronica Voss situation, are comfortable with saying what needs to be said?
Yes, specifically with No Man's Land, A History of Violence, Persepolis, and Dogtooth. But I think it's there in Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring, and Saw as well.
Yeah.
I do want to give an award that I have not given out to a film yet so far on our list. The recipient of said award is Almodovar's incredible film, Balbert. And the name of the award is Film Arthur Absolutely Needs to Revisit.
Because I still remember
the plot, the plot description, and you just that initial discussion. Full disclosure: I haven't heard that episode yet. It hasn't come out yet. But
I have
discussing it was really fun. I did have a great time, and I love that movie. But yeah, I think that upon revisit, you will really enjoy that film and be like, oh, okay, I get it.
I didn't hate that film either or anything like that.
Yeah, no, not at all.
I was going through a bad time. But I also feel like I didn't totally misinterpret it or anything like that. But you do.
You just did think that she was an actual ghost.
I think she is an actual ghost. I don't care what the dialogue in the film says. I'm going to revisit that film. I'm going to prove it to you.
All right. Do you have a favorite film that you watched from this decade?
Twilight. Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actually feel that way?
No. Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring is a masterpiece. Oh, that is a incredible film. 5 stars out of 5 stars. Can't recommend that one enough. I really, really loved it. But Dogtooth is also up there.
Yeah. I felt even from your energy in this recording that you'd really, really loved this movie and this one had connected.
Mm-hmm. But honestly, there is not a film in this decade that I hated. And that includes Twilight. I think we got a great lineup of films, a great variety of films with very different tones that are exploring a lot of different subject matters from around the world. I really loved our lineup here. Like Devdas. Mm-hmm. Our first Bollywood film, my first Bollywood film. And I thought that was an incredible experience. So energetic. Not like anything else I've ever seen. Definitely not like anything else we got on the list. Yeah, it seems weird to compare something like Devdas to Miss Congeniality. I enjoyed both of them so much. But yeah, we're all over the map this decade.
Yes. My favorite film from this decade is also Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring. That movie really resonates with me. But it was so fun getting to do that 2 week in a row No Man's Land and Devdas watch where I was completely blind.
Mm-hmm.
And Devdas has really stuck with me. I keep going back to scenes from it. Actually, I have a coworker. Her name is Emily. And she really likes old movies. I've recommended her a lot of old Hollywood movies that she's liked. And she loves Bollywood movies. She's from Japan and she's way more versed in Asian cinema than I am. So she's seen a lot more Bollywood movies than I have. And I asked her about Devdas and she said, oh my God, I watched that movie every day when I was in high school. I loved it so much. And
oh, I love it.
I think there is a version of Andrew somewhere who found DevDots in high school and watched it every single day.
Yeah.
I really loved that movie. I had a great time with it. It was campy and silly, but it also had a really strong heart, and the musical numbers were incredible. Yeah, and also cool to have seen a film from that director that was much, much better than Saw Waria, which was the first one I watched from him. Miss Congeniality is easily the film I've seen the most on this list. I've watched that movie countless times.
Countless.
And it was fun to watch that again.
It was fun to watch that with you.
Yes. And Saw and A History of Violence were a great 1-2 punch, too.
1-2 punch, too.
I don't know how, but they felt like they were related.
Yeah, History of Violence was... There's a lot going on there that's worth dissecting.
And Persepolis, too. Yeah, was... That was so great getting to revisit that. That the same friend who I watched Mulholland Drive and Dogtooth with, her favorite movie at that time was Persepolis. She was the one who let me borrow her DVD, and then I bought it myself.
Lovely.
It was so good getting to revisit that, because I just had this idea of what that movie was in my head, and it was not a bad movie. It was, you know, a really well animated, but sort of a funny movie. Revisiting it as an adult, it had way more of an impact on me, and I loved it. Yeah, this was a really great lineup of movies, and I did thoroughly enjoy my Twilight revisit. I was pretty drunk when I watched it. Purposefully.
Hell yeah. So was I.
Yeah.
Yeah. Persepolis is an important film. I literally think that everyone in America should watch Persepolis.
Yes.
They might not appreciate it, you know, but it's a great film. I'm really happy that I finally got to see it, and getting the inside perspective of the Iranian Revolution and the war with Iraq. I mean, these are just important topics that I feel like I didn't have the outside perception. I had been dogtooth, you know. I had the American blindfold over my eyes.
Mm.
We don't have any films on this list that are directly about 9/11, but does it feel like 9/11's presence is kind of felt in a lot of these films? I definitely feel it, you know, in Persepolis.
Yes, I felt it. I mean, I feel it in pretty much everything from No Man's Land forward. Maybe not in Volver, but even Twilight, that dark gray color grading that would take over all of Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
that became popular after 9/11. It really did.
Things get violent and dark really, really fast after 2001. Yeah. Yeah, and the color scheme is part of the darkness.
Yes. Well, we even mentioned War of the Worlds, Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds in the History of Violence episode. And I remember watching that film for the first time thinking, I've never seen a movie that quite looks like this. And now every movie looks like that.
Right, right. Twilight also speaks to the burgeoning fandoms of this era. I don't know. I wasn't, you know, part of any 90s fandoms. But I do feel like the internet and the way that people can talk about media in such a quick way during this time period makes fandom a really accessible thing for a lot more people. And Twilight, yeah, speaks to that movement.
Yeah. This was a great lineup of movies. I had a great time watching these. Oh, it's crazy we get to only have this discussion one more time, really.
We'll be looking back on the entire century, not just one decade.
I'm still pitching the idea of a post-show episode where we don't have to watch a movie or anything, but we talk about the whole show then.
I think that's a better idea. I think you're right.
Because that'll be an easy one to record.
Let's do that. You're right.
I mean, you are going to need to re-listen to every single episode, because I'm going to. In backwards order.
Oh, shit.
So I don't have any recency bias.
Yes, thank you for a good lineup of films, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I recommended a lot of these.
What are we watching for 2010?
We start the final decade with Certified Copy, directed by Abbas Kiarostami.
The great Iranian film director, Abbas Kiarostami.
Yes, yes, yes. God, even just looking at this cover, it's such a good cover.
Andrew, thank you for a great show.
Yes, thank you, Arthur. To our regular listeners, this is the end of our episode. We do very much appreciate you tuning in. Don't forget to give our podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the podcast streaming service of your choice. Give us a follow on our Facebook page, which is A Century in Cinema. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our Patreon subscribers. We have a fun episode coming up for you where I'm going to reveal certain details about 2009 that I couldn't reveal to the regular listeners. And thank you so much, Nathan Royal, for our show's music. And thank you, Arthur, for this wonderful discussion.
Thank you, Andrew.